And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. Let's introduce everybody. Glenn Weldon, what do you do for NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do for NPR?
I am the movies editor at NPR.org.
And Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor for NPR Music.
Well, I think it's safe to say that everyone's weekend was dominated by the Tony Awards.
Yes. There's the Tony Awards party. There's the Tony Awards pre-party.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
There is all the sewing of costumes in conjunction mm-hmm. with the Tony Awards.
Stephen pays no attention to the Tony Awards, is what he's telling us.
I believe it was opposite, like, game six of the NBA.
Yes, but you didn't watch that either.
I did.
Did you?
I did. I decided that as a long-ago Clevelander,
Games? They have games for basket weaving?
Oh.
I
don't understand.
Trey. How about you, Glenn Weldon? Did you watch Little Tony Awards?
Sure did, sure, yeah.
Oh, you watched it.
Yeah.
Good man.
At the risk of sounding like I'm criticizing Neil mm-hmm. Patrick Harris, because
sure.
I would gird my Ooh. Loins before that would happen. Let's just say he's hosted an award show or six.
Uh-huh.
I never saw him bring as much as he brought to the table at the Tonys. I really thought he was going all out.
Put down your Playboy and go make a plan to pick up a playbill and feel like a man. There's so much to discover with your different gendered lover. It's not just for gays, the gays and the Jews and cousins in from out of town you have to amuse. And the sad embittered malcontents who write the reviews. And also foreign tourists and the groups of senior citizens and well-to-do suburbanites and liberal intellectuals. Though that group is really only Jews and homosexuals, I've lost my train of thought. Oh yes, it's not just for gays anymore.
The opening number, of course, Not Just for Gays Anymore. Very funny. And the premise of that song, almost instantly belied by the presence of some wiggly sailor butts.
True
the
that,
ones that were hoisting him aloft.
I think it was ironic on purpose, wasn't
that's,
it?
That's
I
what
think
I'm saying. The ironic on purpose nature of that particular opening number was smeared across the television
Absolutely.
Screen.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, among other things, you could tell it was being done with a wink because the choreography itself...
You said wink, right?
With a wink. I did say wink. The choreography itself was very propulsive, yes, very muscular, but awful damn swishy.
Yeah.
That was some swishy choreography
uh-huh,
right there.
It sure was.
When did you notice when they stripped away his tuxedo to reveal him in the Paul Lynde outfit?
I think they actually added the Paul Lynde outfit.
Oh, was it over the tux?
Yeah, over the tux. Because the Paul Lynde outfit was very bulky.
It was a little bulky. Yeah,
and I'm pretty sure they put it on over the suit. And then
right,
the suit
because
was,
the suit came out
the
second
the
later.
Key yeah. outfit.
But if there was ever any question, you know, in the giant flowchart of how gay is this, in the center of that flowchart is a giant diamond that says, is there at least one weather girl? If yes... Because I didn't know what was happening toward the end of the evening.
Yeah.
I did like seeing, my favorite part of that was seeing Paul Schaefer again. I don't watch Letterman Show anymore, mm-hmm. and it's been a long time since I've seen him. But I missed him, because if you notice, he co-wrote It's Raining Men and produced it originally.
I did not know that.
Yes, he did. And when he was presenting it with Martha Wash, when the drag queens came out to dance around him, as is their wont, he did the Jack Benny. He put his hands to his face and was like, Rochester. That was really fun to see again. I missed Paul Schaefer.
You know, when I was watching that number with the Priscilla Queen of the Desert drag queens, and I'm sitting there and it's raining men, and I'm thinking, this is just, this entire thing has so entered the mainstream that you could show this at halftime at an NFL football game.
Sure. Oh,
like,
absolutely.
For real.
It may not be gay enough to be played.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Stadium.
I'm saying it's kind of interesting to me that now it's like drag queens and it's raining men have like not the slightest hint of subversion of any kind.
It also speaks to the fact that this wasn't really aimed at, say, Mike Katziff's generation. I mean, the presence of Brooke Shields, Christie Brinkley, looking crazy.
Yeah.
And
she was, as I said on Twitter, projecting to the back row of my house.
She looked like she wanted to eat my soul. Those were some hungry eyes.
They were.
But yeah, it was really, but I'll tell you, I would see a Stephen Colbert in a bad turtleneck just shucking and jiving his heart out. I love seeing that. I love seeing this creature of pure irony, mm-hmm. whose show mm-hmm. is basically a house of mirrors, just giving it up.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The other thing that we should mention is the closing, which was the rap yep. that was written by the guys who did In the Heights a couple of years ago. And it's somewhat similar to something he did last year. He did a
song. I was going
to
say, he did this on a previous awards. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the previous Tonys, right?
It was the previous Tonys. He did a song based on Tonight from West Side Story. Mm-hmm. But this one was more, I want to say, like a spoken wordy rap. Like yep. it doesn't mm-hmm. have the other elements of a normal rap song.
Daniel Radcliffe kicked some butt, and we were so elated, even Voldemort was sad he wasn't nominated. Oh, that's good. Norbert Leo Butt sang and danced and tried to catch you, coming at you, chasing Trey and Casey because they nabbed a Tony statue. Commencing in the Chattanooga station from the grand imagination of a Kander Ed collaboration. It takes a lot for a recipient to humble me, but everybody cried for gorgeous Nikki James, the bumblebee. Andrew Rannells sang, I believe, and he landed it so well, now he's Mitt Romney's VP candidate. All across the country, from the north into the south, they're saying Brooke's a hottie with a crazy potty mouth. John Larroquette brought an eloquent mood to the room. I'm still imagining him at home in his Fruit of the Looms. Spider-Man and Mary Jane gave us perspective here. They sang a ballad, we didn't need our protective gear. Bettina Miller's nun sang Raise Your Voice with Cheer, and Memphis is relentless, they're performing every year.
And it really is impressive to see how they put those things together on the fly so that they can use them as the closing number. And they incorporate all those things like Brooke Shields and her potty mouth. But, of course, if you didn't see the actual awards and if you haven't heard much about them, the big winner was the Book of Mormon.
Yep.
So it's interesting to me that the controversial nature of the subject matter of that show has not hurt them at all. Like, clearly has not hurt them at all.
Well, I think that's the flip side of the, you know, what Glenn was saying, is that, you know, when Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is the second most challenging musical comedy presented for your amusement on the Tony Awards.
Right.
You know, and this is a show about transsexual and family issues and, you know, a lot of terrorism across the outback, basically. Mm-hmm. A lot of fabric-involved terrorism.
Yeah. Obviously, there are still a lot of people who have problems with the Book of Mormon and the content and everything, both for the Mormon aspect and for the filth. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you filth.
But, yeah. But, I mean, obviously, it's following in the footsteps of Avenue Q, with which it shares some DNA, which is also filthy, mm-hmm. and also did fine awards-wise. So, I guess that's not surprising, but they did clean
yes,
up
indeed
that,
they did.
That show.
Yeah, and they chose, I believe, the song from the show, which is arguably the cleanest. And,
the tamest.
The tamest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was a well, really
it's
a, good
it's the
performance.
Tamest, it's
it was.
The tamest in terms of potty mouth language, but it in fact is the one that is probably most likely to irritate people who feel that their faith is somehow being
right.
poked fun at.
I agree.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, I do think that the Book of Mormon has Trey Parker and Matt Stone in a very interesting place right now. Obviously, Trey Parker and Matt Stone are two of the main people behind the Book of Mormon, also obviously the people behind South Park. And one thing that I think is really, really interesting about how they've sort of come off in the wake of this production coming out and being a huge hit, their public persona is so much less bratty. I mean, as much as there has been some outcry with regard to this play, when I saw that they were going to do this, I expected this gigantic campaign about sort of like they had when they did the South Park movie. Mm-hmm. And they had this huge run-in with the MPAA, and the MPAA says that we can't have, you know, well, and also with Team America World Police, mm-hmm. where, you know, we can't have puppets doing this, and, mm-hmm. you know, where they sort of waged this gigantic kind of wearying public relations war with right. with the sort of the censors, the bad guy.
Right.
And it's an indication to me that those guys have grown up a little bit.
They have certainly not been out to make waves with the way that this production has been presented beyond its content. The, mm-hmm. the waves are from the content, but mm-hmm. Particularly, you know, if you look at the way they were at the Tonys, they didn't act up at the Tonys. They didn't act goofy. Mm-hmm. They didn't provoke particularly. You know, they politely accepted the awards that they got gratefully, and, you know, they were not there to upend the Tony Awards right. or anything like that. Yeah, so the other interesting thing about watching the Tony Awards is always that it winds up in a lot of ways being a good show.
Well, sure.
Partly because it has to. Well, partly because it would logically be a good show because it's people who
it's
are
celebrating excellence in live performance.
Exactly. But at the same time, they also kind of are forced to do that by the fact that most people are not going to have seen the shows, so you can't really be rooting for the stuff that you've seen because, you know, you're lucky if a part of that audience has maybe seen one thing.
Right.
Like
right.
as opposed to they're not going to have seen a significant number It's nothing like the Oscars or the Emmys.
Yeah, the Tony Awards, more so than almost any of the other awards shows, has to be a solid, entertaining variety show.
Well, yeah. do they frame it as sort of a sampler of what is on Broadway?
Increasingly, that is what they've done. And I think that is, A, it's the necessity of their doing that is one of the reasons that they've increasingly turned to people like Christy Brinkley and, and you know, even in the opening number where he walks by Al Pacino down in the front row and says, "You're far too famous for this bit." It's just about giving the audience that look at gigantic celebrities, because half of the people they're going to be hearing from across the course of the evening are not tremendously
famous.
They
will have never heard of.
Do I remember old Tony broadcasts where they would try to give a sop to the straight plays, the dramas? They would reenact a scene maybe from a drama?
For the longest time, they were trying to come up with a good formula for sort of doing justice to the straight plays. They would do these scenes that just go on and on.
I didn't know there was such a thing as a straight play on Broadway. Walk it. You guys could have said it.
We couldn't.
I think
that's hurtful.
They have sort of given up on that, and I think now it's just kind of, let's just have, you know, Sutton Foster and a bunch of people tap dancing.
Or even the scene from How to Succeed in Business was great. The spider ballad kind of stunk up the joint.
It did stink up the joint. It was not good. The spider ballad was not good.
Theoretically, it was the only thing they could probably mount that didn't require just all kinds of rigging, so it was probably the cheapest.
Right, that's the thing.
I don't
I don't think you get the Green Goblin numbers installed in that theater for one night.
Well, the last thing you want to do is have somebody, you know, get hurt.
Killed at the Tony Awards.
But anyway, so we did enjoy the Tony Awards. That was this weekend. Also this weekend, I don't know if anyone else did, but Steven and I went and saw Super 8, which spoiler alert. Did we like it, Stephen?
I loved it.
We loved it. We really, really loved it. We thought it was great. What did you love about it, Stephen?
Wait, let me guess. There were Muppets.
I don't like other people's kids.
Okay.
Well, last week on the show, Trey brought up the trailers before X-Men First Class and declared that none of us were going to have to go to the movies again.
Until October.
Yeah.
That doesn't even get us past Rock'em Sock'em Robots, the movie. clearly, they did not show a trailer for Super 8
before X-Men First Class,
because I thought that Super 8 was terrific. One of the most interesting things about it that I noticed when I saw the box office,
which was not gigantic,
$37 million. The box office was not tremendous, but the fact that the movie cost $50 million to make.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet Mr. Popper's Penguins cost twice that
much. Absolutely.
But this happens all the time, where a very run-of-the-mill movie in which very little happens, and then you find out that the budget is like $180 million.
For the way the movie looks, that is a surprisingly reasonable budget. And I do believe that one of the things that I noticed from the write-ups that I read was that one of the figures said that 71% of the audience was over 25.
I was really taken aback by that.
Which is really not typical. If you compare that to something like The Hangover, where more than half of the audience is under 25, 71% over 25 for movies in general, that's a pretty old skewing audience, relatively speaking. One of the things we talked about was how much it recalls movies, obviously, of our youth.
Yeah, 25, 30 years ago.
The old Spielberg movies and that kind of stuff. But also, as we were talking about, not just the Spielberg movies, which is the easiest reference point, but also Stand By Me, a reference point that has explicitly been made
by the creators of this film.
Of course. And Spielberg is an executive producer on the film and all that. But also Stand By Me, definitely the book, It, and the TV adaptation of that. It does recall a bunch of other stuff, but I felt like it still was very fresh to me. It still was very exciting to me, and I just got a big kick out of it. I don't know how to explain it, but we were just kind of sitting there just grinning and kind of being like, oh, there's something's going to happen right here. Like, it's just, it's fun. I don't know.
So is it something that was particular to this story or this style of storytelling, or is it something that you found in J.J. Abrams' other work?
I think what made this movie effective for me was just that it's not an incredibly innovative story, but it's made with a lot of skill and it's made with a lot of love. What comes through in this movie to me is a overwhelming love of movies, overwhelming love of making great, fun, entertaining, but also sort of touching, but sort of, you know, understanding that the touching parts are sort of somewhat schlocky. And I said to Stephen, the last 5 to 10 minutes of this movie are the least essential 5 to 10 minutes of the movie, because it's kind of the wrapping up and all that stuff, which is always awkward in this kind of story. But I just felt like it was so much fun to watch. It had such a sense of humor about itself. It had such an ability to take an exciting, suspenseful scene, kind of the same way E.T. could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Take a really exciting, suspenseful scene and throw in a joke. And have it be a joke that didn't break the scene. It didn't ruin the rhythm. And it didn't feel like the movie was pushing you away by having a sense of humor. It felt like it was really a kind of warm, inclusive kind of sense of humor.
One of the observations that the creative people have made about this movie, they wanted this to be a movie that is like the best of the Spielberg movies of that era, in that it tells an exciting story, it introduces you to characters that you want to meet, but it sends you out of the theater feeling better than when you came in.
It's also like the best Spielberg movies of that era without the gigantic flaws of some of the Spielberg movies of that era. Like, for example, it sort of celebrates the kind of wonder of youth without
without getting snoopy about it.
Food fights.
Yeah.
There's certainly the kind of kids swearing at each other that, if you remember, obviously memorable kids swearing at each other in E.T. or whatever. It's got a little bit of that, but there's much less like, let's celebrate childhood by throwing food. Mm-hmm. I felt a more realistic portrait of childhood. It had much the same feel in parts as Stand By Me. I tweeted after the movie something that I actually kind of would almost invert and take back. I said, Super 8 achieves what Steven Spielberg wants every movie to accomplish. People who see it as 12-year-olds will romanticize it in 20 years. And seeing that number, that 71% of the audience was over 25, sort of is the indication like, whoops, dude, you're 38. People who are 38 will see it as 12-year-olds.
Right.
I think that's very true.
I didn't see this movie. I'm probably not going to go see it just because the genre, the kids' adventure, the Stand By Me's, the It's, the Spielberg Guiana, none of that really appeals. None of that really just connects with me. And I was not surprised to hear that figure, because that struck me as that's who this film is made for. It's made for people who remember that time very fondly.
Sure.
So, and I don't speak for every nerd, but certainly I sensed among my friends, well, it's not really science fiction. It's a Spielberg movie.
It has elements of science fiction.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. But I mean, it concentrates more on the wonder of youth.
Yeah,
it's not wonder of youth.
Not in an overpowering kind of way. And I have a sort of a good news, bad news on portrayals, which I would also deliver about this movie. The bad news is there is only one girl in it. And her function is essentially, first, everyone has crushes on her, and then she's in peril.
Sure.
And I absolutely cannot argue with people who have noted, like, that's pretty dang tired. And it wouldn't have killed them to have a girl who got to do some more things.
She could at least have a slingshot sticking out of her back pocket.
Exactly. To her credit, Elle Fanning in this movie is terrific. She's really interesting to look at. She does, I think, everything with this part that can possibly be done.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it is a very objectified role, even for a kid that age. The positive portrayal, here is the pudgy kid who is not a joke and not constantly stuffing
food
in his mouth.
Right.
He's the sort of pudgier kid in this movie, is the director of the movie that they're making. And frankly, he's the one who kind of is, you know, running the show a little bit. And he's a kind of a goofball, but not a goofball in an over-the-top, typical movie kid kind of way.
I don't think at any point, that's probably the first role that kid has ever had where he has not had food on his face.
I was going to say, at any point, does he at any point have chocolate on his face?
There is a moment where they're all kind of trading insults, and one of the insults that gets thrown around has to do with him being a bigger kid. But that's going to happen, right? So that part I didn't have a problem with. But his entire character was not defined by that, and having seen so many movies where there's always the one, and he's always like the rah, 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 you know how he's running off and breaking stuff and eating a donut.
He sat on a chair and it broke.
It's the fact that he has a character which has almost nothing to do with that is revelatory, and I give them a point for that. So we kind of got a good news, bad news thing.
Well, and none of the characters ever pointed out that he was going to grow up to be Jerry O'Connell.
That's why he can't do it anymore. So, yeah, Stephen and I enjoyed Super 8 a whole lot, and I think we would both highly recommend it.
Absolutely.
Yes?
Absolutely.
All right. Awesome. Yes. Okay, next piece of business this coming up weekend as you hear this podcast is what, Stephen?
A much less important holiday than Mother's Day?
Coming up this weekend is Father's Day. And
wait. Whose mom listens to this podcast?
And so we did want to make sure that we gave a little bit of attention to Father's Day.
Yes, we did.
So we thought that we would do a little segment we're calling Bleep My Dad Liked. What do they dig? What do we get? What do we not get? Glenn Weldon. Bleep your dad liked.
All right. Well, when we talked on an earlier podcast about the stuff we've inherited from our parents, I kind of went through my dad's list of really mortifying things.
And Patsy Cline. But Patsy Cline.
But Patsy Cline was the thing that kind of saved me. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there was a lot of Engelbert Humperdincks,
yes,
and you're the associations. But between the ages of, like, 6 and 10, it's very important that your parents like your friends. From 11 point on, you couldn't care less. But when you're a young kid, it's very important. And when I was that age, 6 to about 10, my best friend was television. And I was obsessed with it. I memorized all the schedules. I had arguments with my friends, nice, in the Delaware Valley over whether Channel 17 was better than Channel 29.
Oh, well.
Crazy. On the face of it, what a stupid assertion.
I was going to say, Channel 17 was like a low-rent Channel 29.
Definitely.
Up top, Glenn Weldon.
Thank you very much. But, you know, when my dad, he didn't do this often, when he would sit down with me and watch my favorite shows, it's like a huge thing. It's what I got instead of throwing balls with him and playing catch.
Sure.
Because, you know, that wasn't going to happen. That would end in tears. Mostly me, but sometimes him. So my favorite show at the time was MASH. I was obsessed with this show. I would tape it.
At what age?
Well, I was like 6 to 10.
Wow.
Given your love of war?
Yeah. Well, given my love of
cross-dressing.
Yes.
Well, yes, there we go.
There we go. I would tape each and every episode with a tape recorder, paying the microphone over the speaker, and it would make my parents be very quiet
So what you're saying is that your role model was radar.
No, I would listen to it obsessively when I was going to bed, when I was getting ready in the morning, just over and over. If I liked a joke, I would play it over and over again, go shk over and again, and so I realized sitting down there with my dad, and this was a very important lesson, that we can love the same thing for vastly different reasons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He loved the Henry Blake era of the show, the Larry Gelbart era, the first mm-hmm. couple,
right,
the first two or three seasons, which a lot of people will tell you was the peak of the show, its creative peak. And I will disagree with that strongly because of my pitched loathing for one character from that era. Can anybody guess?
Frank Burns.
No, Frank Burns, great comic foil. Loved him. Trapper John.
Oh!
Hated Trapper John, this cocky, jock, egotistical. He is just a joke.
I see where this is going.
He doesn't have a personality.
Seems like he might have played
ball. Why did you hate him?
I was going to say, this is connected to your issues with Shouty Day.
Yeah, it sort of is, actually. It all goes. He's not even a character. He has no depth. Maybe it's my Wayne Rogers hate sort of leaking through. I don't know. I can't. But I over-identified with one Charles Emerson Winchester III.
Of course you did, yes.
Who has, I mean, he's even more cocky than Trapper John, but he has a vulnerability, right? He's got a soul.
Does he?
He's a human being.
Just because he likes the French horn.
No. He's sensitive. He's got a...
No, I hear you.
He's vulnerable. And
you're absolutely
I
right.
wanted to grow up to be Charles Emerson Winchester, and there are days when I think I have achieved that goal. Those are not my best days.
How is that uncontrollable passion for Loretta Swit?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. He hated Charles Emerson Winchester. Hated the character. I know you're kind of supposed to because he's the antagonist.
Sure.
But he hated it in a very pitched way that I started to take personally because when he hated that character, I thought he was hating me. But then we would turn over and watch Barney Miller, his favorite show, and I loved the character of Sergeant Dietrich, played by the great Steve Landisberg, and he loved this character too. And again, I over-identified with Dietrich, so by him thinking that character was funny and laughing at what that character said was, to me, his way of saying that he loved me. That's healthy, right?
Awesome.
That's not weird, right?
I love this story. Yeah. I love this story top to bottom. This is great.
To be fair, I did need a little Enigma machine to kind of decipher all these codes that we sent between us. But, you know, that's my pop.
I think that's awesome. And I also love MASH. Uh-huh. So, hey, I'm on board with that.
My dad was a big MASH fan. He was more in the Alan Alda camp.
Sure.
And probably not least because he looked a little bit like Alan Alda when he was younger. man, I should break out the old photos of my dad. I got some when he's skinny and dark haired and looking like a movie star.
That is awesome.
Nice. The thing I was going to surface, a couple of things. One of the things I was going to surface was my dad had a thing for, I guess you'd call it genre fiction. You'd certainly, I don't know. Maybe you guys tell me. Does Louis L'Amour transcend genre? Is he a better writer than just generic Western?
It's genre fiction, but you're asking the right question.
But it's genre fiction at a high level.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So he had a shelf full of Louis L'Amour books. Just loved him. It was one of his getaways, his escapes. And he had all of the Bond books. He was a big fan of the Bond books. And that's how I was introduced to spy fiction, was with those. I liked the Bond stuff, never quite got the Louis L'Amour stuff. Like, I've never been a gigantic Western fan. But what I did, I think, inherit from my dad more so than my mom, was the absolute desire to immerse myself in a book. My mom reads, and my mom encouraged my reading, as we have discussed on this podcast,
we
with
have.
The whole purchase of an encyclopedia
you were
thing.
Always unusual.
You were always unusual. But my dad was the one whose example, I think, without even my ever really consciously realizing it at the time, but in retrospect, I think it was in part his example that made me feel comfortable sitting in a chair and reading a book for hours and vanishing into that world and being transported. And you know, the idea that that was an okay way to pass time.
And ignore your children. That's what you're saying. So now you get a free pass.
All of your loved ones.
It doesn't have to be all about pain, I'm
yes.
saying.
So, yeah, books as pop culture, books as entertainment, books as
well,
books
something
as
enjoyable,
fun.
Something enjoyable.
Yeah, books
something
as something
that he
to
did
enjoy.
For pleasure.
Books,
yeah, absolutely.
Trey, books as something to talk about with your friends, too?
No.
Interesting.
So he wasn't like a book club guy?
No, yeah. Not that. One of the other things that was absolutely a characteristic of my dad that I wish I'd inherited, you know that part of the Serenity Prayer where it says, it talks about the serenity to accept the things you cannot change?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's totally my dad. My dad is really good at that, and I've sort of been trying to follow him down that road for most of my adult life. Let's just say I keep his example ever before me because I ain't quite there yet.
That's wonderful. Very, very good.
Serenity so what you're saying is what you've learned from your parents is a standard to which you cannot.
I can never live. Yeah, yeah.
You're also
yeah.
saying that the Serenity Sorry, Prayer counts as pop culture, which I think is interesting.
I like it. Stephen Thompson.
Okay, so many things. I'm looking at an old black and white photo of my dad as I read this, and I see I have taken from him a love of my horn rimmed glasses, but not a love of his high waisted pants.
It's a look, Stephen. You should consider it.
First of all, my dad was an incredibly, incredibly voracious reader in ways that seems to have skipped a generation, but does live on through Thompsonia. My parents, Glenn, not only did they tape TV shows using an audio cassette recorder, they took Polaroids to go
to go with them. Nice.
I am your long-lost brother.
You were the son my mother never had.
That's true.
As we have said many a time.
My dad was just a voracious consumer of popular culture. You know, everything from science fiction and fantasy and comic books, you know, which is how his love of comic books was how he made his living for the last 20-some years of his life. And before that, he was a newspaper man. Hmm. And among at the Cleveland Press, the defunct Cleveland Press, and he held, I think, a position at some point or another on every desk except for sports, making him the son that Glenn Weldon, making Glenn Weldon the son that my father never had. And one of the desks that he was on very early in his career at the press, so this would be the early 60s, he wrote a rave review of a very early Bob Dylan record, in which he said that Bob Dylan was so good that he would be the next Woody Guthrie. And he got roasted over an open flame by readers for saying that. And that was always one of his sort of things that he was sort of proud of, that he was a very, very, very early adopter saying that Bob Dylan was great. I ended up meeting Billy Bragg about 10 years ago when he was doing his album of Woody Guthrie covers with Wilco. I told Billy Bragg that story of how my dad had said that had likened Bob Dylan to Woody Guthrie. And as Billy Bragg and I are parting ways, Billy Bragg reaches out and he says, I'm not going to do his accent. He says, hey, tell your mom that when this record comes out, we're going to make Woody Guthrie the next Bob Dylan.
Nice.
Isn't that nice?
That's awesome.
So yeah, from my dear father, I mean a love of Dylan, a love of old stand-up comedy LPs. Mm-hmm. I mean all of this stuff. My parents were so close together in every phase of their lives that it's very, very hard for me to separate
right. My
father's loves from my mother's loves, because they were equally profoundly influential on me. Mm. I learned a tremendous amount culturally from both my parents. So it's very hard to say, this is dad.
Mm-hmm.
But Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck comics, the fact that my sister and I would sit on the big arms of this gigantic pink chair, this ugly pink chair, and my dad would just read us comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn, I wish you could have come over.
Yeah. That's okay. I had TV.
So anyway, that's my dad. Good man.
Very, very good. It's funny that you mentioned both Woody Guthrie and stand-up comedy albums, because two of the things I wanted to mention. My dad has a great love of folk music and was certainly loved Pete Seeger and the Weavers.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff like that, which I still listen to.
And same goes for my parents across the board.
Which I still listen to. My dad was always very interested in Woody Guthrie. He also loves bluegrass music. I always try to find him like Tiny Desk concerts that have threads of those things, and I always send them to my dad and I say, you will hear elements of the thing you like in here, and I'm usually right. And he usually writes back and says, oh yeah, I really liked that. I really thought that was cool. My dad also had these stand-up records like Shelley Berman, if you've heard Shelley
sure.
Berman, who does the coffee, tea, or milk airplane routine about how we can get there ahead of time if you put it down in the Grand Canyon. And it's really, really funny. And then he has this great one that I could do most of. I won't, but about the guy.
And
that,
now here it is.
About a guy who calls a department store because there's a woman hanging out of the window of the department store and he can see her from across the street and they keep transferring So you hear like 40 times this guy saying, there's a woman hanging from a window of your store. And then I said, I don't know if the bags are from your store, madam. I don't know why that matters. And then he starts talking to the woman out the window and yelling across to her like, you know, you have packages between your legs. Just let them go. It's okay. Just say, oh, yeah, let them go. There you go. There you go. Oh, poor fella.
Hello, complaint department. You don't know me. I work in the office building right across the street from your store, and no, the Southwest. And I was just sitting and looking out of my window, and no, pretty nice out. And I noticed there's a woman hanging from a window ledge on your store, about 10 flights up. She's about to fall down unless we get hello there. Hello, hello. Oh, hello, madam. Listen, what happened to the man I was just talking to? Oh, well, put a cold towel behind his neck. That'll bring him out of it. It's my fault. I
knew that whole thing. And that was from when I was a little kid. Like, that was when I was, like, 7, probably, that I listened to that stuff. Also, a little bit of Alan Sherman, who did Hello, Mudda, Hello, Fun, and all that stuff. So definitely, if you hate my sense of humor, much of the blame. Well, what I always say about my parents is that my mother has a much more sort of word-oriented kind of, my mom is great with the little one-liner, the little one-liners and stuff like that. And my dad, in addition to obviously being a really smart guy and having a really smart sense of humor, also has a really goofy sense of humor, like a really broad kind of will do many, many broad things for a laugh.
Sure. Would you say corny? Like dad
yes,
joke corny?
Yes. But
it is
but
a
not,
it is a dad's responsibility.
It's endemic
to be corny.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents are both corny, but absolutely, I would definitely say that. So
my dad's sense of humor is much more sarcastic and teasy. And you could always tell when he thought he had gotten a good zinger off, because he would laugh like like a Huckleberry Hound.
Was that Muttley?
Yeah. No, sorry. Yeah, it was a Huckleberry Hound, Muttley, whoever that guy is, who goes.
Yeah, I have a
That'd
real
be Muttley, not yeah. Huckleberry Hound. So,
okay. I definitely have a real I have a real love for my dad's laugh and my mom's laugh. Oh. And also my sister's laugh. My sister is one with a cascade laugh where she starts to make herself laugh and then
she makes
herself laugh more.
Yeah.
And then she can't stop
the
laughing.
Act of laughing.
And I find
fears.
It the funniest thing in the entire world when she gets going like that. So As I said, if you don't like my sense of humor and my tendency to engage in puns at times and things like that, you'll have to blame my parents because it's their fault. Before we get on to our final segment, which is going to be what's making us happy this week, I did want to take care of two quick pieces of business. One is that Stephen had talked about reading another book.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And I believe he has
about
come.
That.
He was hoping we had forgotten.
But he has come to a decision about the book he's going to read. Stephen, what book are you reading?
I'm going to read A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan.
Yay. Very, very good. Yay. Good choice.
I know very little about it, which is sort of part of the fun.
But what's odd, like, that's like an award-winning book.
If I'm going to read a book a year, it's not going to be Danielle Steele.
You're doing a great job. You're doing a great job.
By reading the Pulitzer Prize winner of the year, you can be pretentious at parties.
Well, the important thing is that I will be able to consider if I read one of these books a year, I will be able to consider myself well-read by the year 27,000.
Mm-hmm. It's going to open up a whole new world for you. The other little piece of business I wanted to mention is that I have a gift for Glenn Weldon.
Yay! Aww.
Which came in the mail to me from our listener, Jason the Minnesotan. Go, Jason. Hello and thank you. Many of you may remember that Glenn was kind enough to lend me an anniversary copy of The Hobbit, which then was stolen from me. Stolen, I say. And I had mentioned a couple weeks ago that I hadn't yet found the right edition, and Stephen pointed out this is because I'm afraid of eBay, which mm-hmm. is sort yep. of true. It was never my intention that anyone would bail me out, but someone did. And so Jason really? Sent us the same copy of the book, along with a note that said something like, I can imagine how you feel. I know that if someone loaned something precious to me and I lost it, I would feel terrible. I was like, I'm sorry, I do feel terrible.
Wait, so you're basically being guilted from two directions about this book?
No, not at all. It was an incredibly sweet note. It was an enormously kind gesture.
It's a very nice thing to do.
Incredibly kind.
It is a very nice
thing.
I kid, Jason. I kid.
That's incredible.
It's very nice.
It was a wonderful, wonderful, sweet, kind thing to do. It is the same book in the same slipcase. It has
it's amazing.
It has everything. I'm out of karmic debt except
and now,
to Jason.
But then we're going to have to put an end to this. We're going to have to ask people not to send things to us.
And where is this book now?
It's in my...
I stole it.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Are you certain?
Yes, it's at my desk.
It's in a secure location.
It's at my
desk. The important thing is the copy you're getting back from Linda is just as unread as it was when it was stolen.
How's that coming, Linda? You were reading it, weren't you? All right, let's just focus on the book. Okay, let's focus on getting the book back.
The good news. Right. That's our internal business for this week, so we can move on to our final piece of new business, which is what's making you happy this week. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
All right, I'm going to snootify the proceedings a little bit, going to raise the level of the discussion.
Oh, are you Charles Emerson Winchester?
As a matter of fact, actually, I didn't think about that, but yes, by mentioning an article I read in the July Harper's Magazine. It's an interview with a writer I admire very much, George Saunders. It's actually an excerpt from a longer interview that first appeared in May on the blog of Bomb magazine, B-O-M-B. He tells a story of cutting through Rockefeller Center, finding the little chocolate shop there, and seeing in the window, and getting this little burst of childlike joy, of this feeling of Christmas is coming and vacation is starting, and then it kind of, you know, immediately as soon as it came up, it went away. But he, being a writer, you know, as he was walking away, he started thinking, well, what can I do with that? And he was reasonably certain that he could write about it and capture it because he's a really good writer. But then immediately, as soon as he came up with that, he thought, well, what happens next? Something needs to happen. I can't just let that sit there. And he decided, he goes through several different scenarios, and he decides that probably what he'd do is have somebody go up to the window, see that display, get a childlike joy, and then get impaled through the head with an icicle.
Which is your speed.
Well, no, this is the thing. Because he then goes on, and this is why I think he's such a brilliant writer, he then interrogates that feeling. Why do I automatically go there? Why can't I let that moment sit? Mm-hmm. Why do I feel this need to go for what he calls the obligatory edgy? Mm-hmm. And he writes, sometimes when I read new fiction, I feel that the writers of it, myself included, have a somewhat dysfunctional relationship with our own culture. I don't mean we disapprove of it. I mean we have absorbed so much habitual disapproval of it that we're no longer able to see it, and therefore unable to disapprove of it properly. How can we disapprove or approve of something you no longer see? If your palette of possible modes of representation has been habitually narrowed and restricted to the edgy, the snarky, the hip, if that palette has been shorn of, say, the spiritual, the ineffable, the earnest, the mysterious, of awe, wonder, humility, the truly unanswerable questions, then there isn't much hope of any real newness there. Now, that sentiment is not new. That sentiment of irony is corrosive and why can't we all love each other, blah, that is not new. But
that was like the most snarky thing I've ever heard you say, by the way.
But it usually comes from the critical establishment. This, it's coming from a man who is not only just a brilliant writer, but also one of our leading ironists of his generation. A very funny, certainly one of the smartest, and one of the funniest ironists, or somebody who uses irony very heavily. And what I love about this piece is that there are no blanket statements, no blandishments. It's precise, it's well articulated, and it's honest. He ends the piece by saying, you know what, if... it turned out that the icicle through the head was more interesting, I'd probably go with it. But I love the idea that here's a guy who irony and edginess is his tool, but he uses it cautiously. And he's thinking about it. He's very honest with himself. He kind of looks back at his own career, assesses what he's done and what he hasn't yet done.
Yeah.
So it's a great piece. So it's in the July Harper's. It's also from the blog on Bomb Magazine, an interview with George Saunders.
Very good. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
There are a bunch of things that are making me happy. The Webby Award, for instance, for the It Gets Better campaign is making me happy.
Very good.
You know, Father's Day is making me happy. My dad's making me happy. But in the wake of last week's Making Me Happy, which was all about a particular performance in a particular production of Stephen Sondheim's musical Follies,
yes,
I have been reading a book about the creation of Stephen Sondheim's Follies, which is by one Ted Chapin, who is the head of the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization, the present day. In other words, you know, he runs the organization that controls all the musical rights and sort of maintains the legacy of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and controls the rights and sort of manages the public presentation of many a present-day musical theater person as well. But back in the day, when Follies was being conceived and rehearsed and tried out of town, Ted Chapin was a college student doing a work-study project as a production assistant on Follies. And he kept a diary, and he wrote this memoir of the show's creation. And it is just chock-full of fascinating information about how a show is put together. If you've never thought about what it takes to get a live performance on its feet, to circle back to sort of what we were talking about earlier with sort of what makes theater theater and what makes the Tonys sort of good at what it does. If you've never thought about all the mechanics that have to come together in one moment in time to make a show happen, then read this book, because his understanding of it is extraordinary, and his mode of storytelling is so clean and so clear and so much fun. It's also just full of hilarity. There are two great quotes on facing pages, one of them from the aforementioned Larry Gelbart. He uses it to describe that moment when you're trying a show out of town, and everyone's tempers are so frayed that the slightest spark could bring the whole enterprise crashing down around everyone's ears. The Gelbart quote is, "I've always hoped that if Hitler was alive, he'd be out of town with a musical." And on the page facing that is another quote from Boris Aronson, who designed the set, a sort of legendary set designer of Russian extraction, who spoke with an accent. And he talks about the dynamic that sort of happens when a show is coming together and the sort of standout performances are beginning to emerge. You know, the performances that suddenly everybody knows it's going to be the talk of the town. The audience is going to love them. When that happens, if they affect the balance of the show, the rest of the cast can begin to resent that person. And the term of art in the trade is the victim. But of course, Boris Aronson, having a heavy Russian accent, says, there are only two rules in the theater. There is always a victim. Number two, don't be the victim. And that, again, on facing pages, those two things. Just fantastic observations about the nature of musical theater. And it's hundreds of pages of that. And it's a fantastic book. I highly recommend it. It is called Everything Was Possible, The Birth of the Musical Follies.
Wonderful. Nice. Absolutely outstanding.
Trey Graham taking his one-man show of Boris Badenov on the road.
Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
I have three recommendations. Two pop culture in origin, and one is personal, and an indulgence that I pray you will forgive. One is coming out Tuesday, June 21st, Alpocalypse, the new album by Weird Al Yankovic, in which somebody might know is thanked in the liner notes.
Stephen's pointing to himself.
Hopefully
for the radio listener, Stephen Thompson is pointing to his own head.
And it's great fun. It's got some material that he put on an EP, an EP called Internet Leaks, where there were videos on YouTube. Those songs are on there. So it's, some of it will be stuff that people have heard that have never actually just been on one of his albums. His T.I. parody of Whatever You Like is on there. So, you know, it's a fun record. It leads off with the much discussed Lady Gaga parody.
Right.
It's terrific. Comes out June 21st. Thing two, Guy's Night.
Yes.
Guys Night is a wonderful band that both Linda and I enjoy, and they have a song that I try to make the song of the day every Friday before Father's Day. And the song is called Father's Day.
You taught me how to shave my face. You taught me to get smarter. And when I came in second place, you said I could try harder. For the laws you taught me to obey, the sports you taught me how to play. And because I turned out okay, every day is Father's Day. You're the boss.
This incredibly ridiculous, just funny, awesome anthem for dads everywhere.
It is great. And thanks, Dave Bunting.
Thanks to our pal Dave Bunting, who is a part of Guys Night. But it is tremendous, tremendous fun. And make sure you send the link to your dad if you are so inclined.
So what you're saying is that your Father's Day song is sort of the up happy alternative to my traditional Mother's Day song, which is Merle Haggard's "Mama Tried."
The third thing that is making me happy, the third and final thing, is again a personal indulgence. We've gotten a couple of pieces of mail asking us, can you guys please make Stephen Thompson stop talking about his kids?
You have not.
Yes, we have.
We have.
And I will.
I have gotten your cards and letters and passed them along as I said I would.
So I will keep this to a minimum. In this very studio. Within the last week or so, I had my kids come in with the help of our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, and we recorded the three of us a little roundtable discussion that we decided to call Thompson Family Happy Half Hour, which would be like a version of Pop Culture Happy Hour, but with me and my kids. And, you know, I'd been talking about doing this with them for ages, and finally sort of got them in one place, and our Thompson Family Happy Half Hour took 64 minutes.
Mike's like, well, so par for the course.
And the A segment, A Ways We Irritate Each Other, took 34 minutes.
There you go.
They're going to play that at your funeral, right?
Yeah.
That'll always be the dream.
Was it like issue 2, bedtime? That'd be fun.
It was
8 o'clock? Wrong!
Yes, it was a lot like that. It was enormous fun. And where this comes in, the only reason I'm acknowledging this on the podcast, having been begged to stop doing this, it is my Father's Day gift recommendation that you gather up your dad or your kids or however, whatever configuration you like, grab a tape recorder and sit around and document a conversation. Of the heirlooms that I have of my father, that is the thing I treasure most, is having documents of actual conversations we had, because they're just preserved in amber. And you can't do it enough. And in this day and age, you can set up your iPhone to take a nice video of a conversation that you have with a loved one. And that is my heartfelt Father's Day gift recommendation. Don't buy any of the things that people traditionally buy their dads for Father's Day. Do that.
Fortunately, what's making me happy this week is not about Stephen's kids. it often is, but not this week. What's making me happy this week involves the words, "This license is effective until terminated. Your rights under this license will terminate automatically without notice from Apple if you fail to comply with any terms of this license."
Yeah, yeah.
Now, those words are from the iTunes end user license agreement, which you probably have never read when you use iTunes. But the nice people at CNET managed to get Richard Dreyfuss to read a bunch of the language from the iTunes EULA, as they call it, and they posted it in a series of sound files, which he did in different voices. But the language that I just read is done in kind of angry, stereotypical movie German of the type that Glenn is so good at. When you hear words like, "Your rights under this license will terminate automatically without notice," and they come out as, you know, "Your rights under this license will terminate automatically without notice," like, it's much funnier. And it's not until you hear them done that way that you realize how menacing the words in the license actually are.
"Your rights under this license will terminate automatically without notice from Apple if you fail to comply with any terms of this license. Upon the termination of this license, you shall cease all use of the Apple software and destroy all copies, full or partial, of the Apple software. Thank you.
And again, it's Richard Dreyfuss reading from the Apple iTunes end user licensing agreement. And it's at CNET, and we will actually remember to link to it. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes I don't, but I will. And that made me enormously happy this week.
I wholeheartedly endorse that choice.
That is very good news for me. So that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham. Like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mm-hmm. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which is making you happy right now. And thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Wouldn't miss
thanks, man.
And thanks to all of you for being here, and we will see you back here next week.